It's a term that's being used, and it's language we need to be very careful about, because you don't want to be throwing around comparisons lightly. But I do think there is something in the language that's being spoken of, whether it's new fascism, neo-fascism, or whatever it is, that sense that we have been here before. And it's this mixture of populism, populist fear, playing on resentment, identification of groups to be scapegoated or blamed, crisis of identity, there's a disillusionment with democracy, and then fascination, strong, charismatic leaders. Look at what happened 100 years ago, learn what we can from it, recognizing their differences as well as similarities. But it seems to me that that's an obvious thing that we should be doing. There's a book that came out in 2010 by a British scholar called Nicholas Boyle. That was kind of tongue-in-cheek, but it was called 2014, How to Survive the Next Big Crisis. And his thesis basically was that in the second decade of every century, we seem to have some big crisis. Something's going to happen, he says, in the next few years. And my money is on 2014. But he got it wrong by a couple of years. 2016 is the marker for most of us, with the presidential election in the States and with Brexit. And now 2020 is being defined by Corona. And those crises coming together, it's a pandemic, it's also a political and economic crisis. That's the kind of brew out of which desperate political solutions emerge. And I think that's what we're seeing, and that's what we need to be attentive to.
So if we're being attentive to it, part of that attention would be the differences as well. And there are differences this time around. What do you see them as?
Well, one would hope that part of the difference is that we have been there before and we do recognise the patterns. And that hopefully that will help us to deal with them. I suspect the fact the world's more globalised than it was a century ago, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing in terms of dealing with the situation. And we have had the experience of the last 70 years of attempts to build transnational, multinational institutions. Now, those are in crisis at the moment, but there has been an attempt to try and bring ourselves together and avoid these kind of crises. So we've had at least the experience of that kind of construction. So it's not as if we'd be starting from scratch again. But, I mean, the fragility of those institutions is very evident. I guess the other thing that is different for us, and again, whether this is something that makes things more severe for us, but I think the whole rise of social media and the capacities of social media for distorting situations and magnifying, I suppose this is the thing, social media magnifies what's there, and something that could have been localized suddenly finds it's all over the place. So the contagious aspect of social media, for good or ill, is something that has to be dealt with. I would also say, I think in many ways, we are dealing with what some people would talk about, the kind of postmodern cultural norms around skepticism about truth.
This crisis of truth. It seems to me, and I don't know what you think about this, but in times gone by, there was truth and there was falsehood. But you could rely on, if somebody was telling lies, that people would say, well, they're telling lies, and they would therefore be unmasked, and there may be a reaction when that was found out. Whereas it seems now that people tell lies, like Donald Trump is a classic example, and people actually kind of know they're being lied to, but they don't care.
I think that's one of the aspects of the fascism, that people are saying, we like what this man is saying, and it doesn't matter if he's saying something different tomorrow. And it's part, as I say, of a kind of cultural thing. That's what our academies have been living with for a long time, the idea that there's no such thing as truth and so on. And it's kind of seeped into the wider political culture in particular, people saying, yeah, we know he's an actor, we know he's in being insincere. But there's a sincerity about his insincerity, if you like. One of the commentators on this question of new fascism refers us to, I think, Nietzsche, of course, the great philosopher that everybody draws on these things. Said, one day, actors will be the real masters. And I remember them saying that when Ronald Reagan became president. It's got to the stage where actually that's what we want these people to be. That blurring is very much part of the postmodern condition. It's to do with the idea that we can create our own realities. And that's what's all that's happening. Trump was creating his own reality. People are being drawn into that and going along with that.
It's breathtaking in a way, because genuinely I think there was a time in the past when if somebody told a big, massive, porky lie, and then some investigative journalist brought it out and it was a scandal, and they'd be gone. Whereas nowadays you are left wondering, I can lie with impunity. Donald Trump says he can kill somebody with impunity on Fifth Avenue. But there is a real crisis.
You mentioned the word impunity there, and I think that leads into a second set of reflections, which I think are also important. We need to look at the last century in order to look at the phenomenon of fascism and to understand that. And that's one kind of investigation that we need to be aware of. But I think the second is this 500-year history of political secularization. And this is where political theology comes in, the theological bit of this. The shift or the transference of sovereignty from medieval kingship to the people, or to the sovereignty of the people, that has not been anything like as smooth a transition as we like to think it has been. And I think there's all kinds of vestiges of divinity and sacred power that have been caught up in that and haven't gone away. Part of what we're dealing with is, especially when democracy is seen to be in crisis, there is a nostalgia for the absolute monarch, the figure who had all kind of power. And I think this is what Donald Trump is tapping into. He and his supporters don't want him to be president. They want a monarch. And this is somebody who is unconstrained by legal or constitutional boundaries. There's a kind of impunity that goes with that. But there's also an immunity. And the medieval king not only was somebody above the law, that he didn't answer to anybody except God, but he was also seen as being immune in the sense of being free from disease. He had healing powers, and therefore he couldn't be touched by the plague and all the rest of it. Even something as relatively trivial as Trump refusing to wear a mask. This is Trump saying, I am immune. This disease won't get me. I am above even the kind of pandemic. And it's tapping into a very powerful image which subconsciously people are relating to, which is very, very scary. But it goes back quite a long way.
And Micah, that's very interesting. Do you think that need in people for this kind of divine ruler, is that aligned to the rise of secularism and the absence of God in politics, any kind of God? Or is it more a psychological thing where people at a certain infantile or up to pre-adolescent stage want to be told what to do and feel that they're being looked after by a big mommy and daddy in the sky?
I'd imagine it's a lot of those things mixed in together. But there's certainly something around projection with the fascination that we have with strong leaders. The leader is someone who successfully performs very dramatic actions full of symbolism. I think the latest example of Trump once again going to the church and holding up a Bible, in a sense it doesn't matter what that means. It's Trump asserting his authority, saying, I can go where I like and all the rest of it. And there's a need, I think, in a lot of us for seeing that kind of power as something that I would like for myself. I would like that myself, to be untrammeled and to be able to do whatever I like to do.
And we see it in a number of leaders, not just Trump. You've got Kim Jong-un, you've Putin, you've Bolsonaro. You have people in Britain who would say it's Dominic Cummins as opposed to Boris Johnson, power behind that throne in a way. Do you think it's because in a democracy, also, everybody is equal. Everybody should and fights to have a vote when they get to a certain age. And that, in a way, is quite a radical thing, that everybody is equal.
It is, and that obviously creates the tensions from people who don't want to admit that. People are threatened by that. It's the idea that my self-worth comes out of being better than somebody else. That's obviously part of what fuels racism, and it's very striking, very sad that the issues of race and gender are so dominant, even after decades of progress. Yeah. And we seem to be back to square one. The idea that, you know, I get my self-worth from being superior to somebody else. It's also another thing where you say, yeah, democracy is very exciting, it's very radical. It's also very boring. And I think what actually happens in terms of you get to vote once every 4 or 5 years, and that's very, very precious and very, very important. But if there's nothing happening in the meantime, democracy doesn't actually mean very much. And they do what they like, and then they come every 5 years to ask for some kind of affirmation. It's actually a very boring kind of system. Part of what I think is interesting in this idea of the absolute monarch that I was mentioning earlier on, there's a kind of liturgy that has to go on as well. And I want to say liturgy, there needs to be some kind of public acknowledgement. So when you go to a religious service, you say amen, that you kind of respond. If you look at somebody, once again, like Trump, the need for affirmation, whether that's the crowds at his rallies cheering his name, whether it's his Twitter feed, whether it's ratings, that obsession with approval and of acclamation, that's part of the kind of politics we're talking about, the cheering crowds and the waving and the physical approval that we associate with populist politics. That's much more exciting than going into a polling booth once every 5 years and marking across. An awful lot of politics happens outside of democratic processes. So we need something that will involve people, because again, part of what we're dealing with is the fact that most people feel excluded from politics, that don't trust the politicians, that don't really feel involved or listened to. So there's something there about being recognised. You mentioned earlier on whether it was a kind of infantile need. There is something about our need for attention that, once again, politics speaks to, and kind of politics of this popular style. He's speaking for me. He's listening to me. He's listening to my concerns and all the rest. And, of course, it's a magic trick, because if you're in a crowd of 5,000 people, how is it that he's listening to you? He might be pointing at you, and you can feel as if here's somebody who acknowledges my existence. So it's on that very basic human level, where do I get my self-worth from? Where do I get my attention from? And for a religious person, my attention comes from my relationship with God. God gives me my self-worth and my self-value. But if God isn't part of the picture, where does that come from? So there's a kind of echoing effect, or mirroring effect, that the fact people are pointing out the narcissism that's at work in somebody like Trump, who draws in the attention of people and the attention seeking. Well, on some level, that's all of us looking for attention, looking for affirmation.